Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Now comes the choice for Congress, for the American people, on the American deficit. Republican Paul Ryan has laid out a path. President Obama has, as of yesterday, laid out a way. Both claim more than $4 trillion in deficit cutting. But the ways are different. This hour, On Point, two ways of deficit cutting and what they would mean for the country. You can join the conversation. What's your first reaction? Which way are you leaning, Ryan or Obama? And are we really going to act here or try to slip the noose again? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. It was Paul Ryan first, Republican congressman of Wisconsin, chairman of the House Budget Committee. This was last week. Here he is at the press conference announcing his plan.
This is a budget that creates economic growth, job creation. It's a budget to pay off our national debt. It's a budget to get our fiscal track on the right track. And so we believe that we have a moral responsibility to step in and provide the leadership that the president has not been providing.
Yesterday, the president stepped in and he began his 44-minute-long speech at George Washington University in Washington, criticizing Paul Ryan's plan.
This vision is less about reducing the deficit than it is about changing the basic social compact in America. Ronald Reagan's own budget director said there's nothing serious or courageous about this plan. There's nothing serious about a plan that claims to reduce the deficit by spending $1 trillion on tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. And I don't think there's anything courageous about asking for sacrifice from those who can least afford it and don't have any clout on Capitol Hill. That's not a vision of the America I know.
Mr. Ryan, what do you think of the president's plan? He spoke up quickly after the president's speech yesterday.
What we got was a speech that was excessively partisan, dramatically inaccurate, and hopelessly inadequate to addressing our country's pressing fiscal challenges. What we heard today was not fiscal leadership from our commander-in-chief. What we heard today was a political broadside from our campaigner-in-chief.
Paul Ryan speaking after President Obama yesterday. We've got a lot to sort out here. Joining us now from San Francisco is Linda Bilmes. She's a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School, teaches budgeting and public finance, served as chief financial officer and assistant secretary of management and budget at the U.S. Department of Commerce from 99 to 01 at the end of the Clinton administration. Linda Bilmes, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi. And with us from Kansas City, Missouri, is Maya McGinnis, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, director of the Fiscal Policy Program at the New America Foundation. She served as Social Security advisor to John McCain's presidential campaign in 2000. The Wall Street Journal calls her an anti-deficit warrior. Maya McGinnis, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Linda, let me come first to you, if I may. We've got two broad ways on the table now. What do you make of these two? I guess the first question is, are they serious? Are both or either of them serious on the deficit front?
Well, I'm feeling enormously proud of the president today. I think his plan that he came forward with was very much provided a great deal of leadership and really tackled the question of, from the perspective of why do we have this big debt problem? Usually if you have a big problem, the first step is to ask, why do we have this problem? And in this case, the main reasons that we have a $14 trillion debt is that we had two enormous tax cuts, which were targeted to the wealthy. And so the first step is to restore more normal tax rates in this country, which he has called for doing. And then I think that he has taken an approach in which we are able to maintain the high priority government spending for the needy, for the poor, for the elderly, without dismantling these core programs. So I am very pleased with the steps that he has taken. And I think that regarding Congressman Ryan's plan, it really makes no sense. We've just discovered that the GE pays no taxes legally, and it has billions of dollars in U.S. profits. Yet his plan is to cut taxes even further on such companies. And his plan would also fundamentally change the healthcare system that millions of seniors depend on. It just is not a sensible plan primarily because it doesn't tackle revenues, but also because the plan itself, when you look at it, it doesn't make sense for America.
Linda Bilmes, we see you very firmly then in the Obama camp here. We'll explore what that plan, what that way would mean. Maya McGinnis, of course, has a very different ways of looking at this. Senator Jim DeMint, South Carolina Republican, saying yesterday the president made it absolutely clear that Democrats will cling bitterly to deficit spending until our nation is bankrupt. New platitudes, same old policies. How do you look at these two paths, Maya?
Well, I think first that it's terrific that the president kind of entered this discussion. In many ways, it was probably long overdue, because one of the things I was struck listening to the speech is you just can't do this without presidential leadership. And President Obama hasn't been particularly engaged in this so far. He put out a budget in February, and the budget was frankly just it wasn't going to do anything. It wasn't going to deal with the deficits or the debt. And even the administration kind of acknowledged that. And in some ways, I fear what happened was a void was left. And this was a little bit of a budget do-over. But a good do-over it was, because the president came out and he said, here's a framework for starting the discussion. And what I think was good about it is he put everything on the table, which is exactly what we have to do. We have to say all parts of the budget have to be looked at, and we have to deal with the deficit and the debt very seriously, and put in place kind of a plan for the next 10 years. You know, we've been focusing recently on a budget for the 5.5 months that are left in the fiscal year. We really need to be thinking about a longer-term budget. And that's the right framework and the starting point of the discussion. What I think was really, unfortunate is that it was a very political speech. And what we really need is the beginning of a bipartisan discussion. Nobody should think we're going to get this done without all parties, both parties, and all people being at the table. And it was more political than I think was necessary. He started the discussion, but I wish it had been – the tone had been different. And he also wasn't specific. He didn't embrace the full savings recommended by his own fiscal commission, which, by the way, I think is a really excellent starting point for this discussion. The fiscal commission would save $4 trillion over a decade, looks at all parts of the budget, pretty aggressive on all parts. This is kind of watered down. It has far less savings in the decade, stretches out to a longer period of time to make the savings look a little bit bigger. And I think in the end, they didn't specify how they would actually come up with these savings. So I think, listen, there's different paths to get to bringing our debt down. But I think Paul Ryan here has been very, very specific and, in fact, has done something difficult. He put difficult ideas on the table. Whether you like them or you don't like them, they're not easy to do. And that's what's going to be required to fix this problem. I think the president still has been overly cautious about saying, listen, this is going to require tough things. I think revenues do have to be on the table, but let's not kid ourselves. This isn't just about asking millionaires and billionaires to pay more. This is going to be about shared sacrifice, and we have to get a little bit realer than this policy framework actually was. We're going to have to go a lot farther.
Maya, could I just start at the very basics here? With each of these two plans, they both claim, in President Obama's case, $4 trillion in deficit cutting in 12 years, and Paul Ryan's about $4.4 trillion in 10 years. Do you buy those numbers? Do you see enough in the frameworks being put before us here that those look like credible savings, real savings, and enough to get American fiscal reality back in balance, Maya?
Well, nobody knows exactly how much we have to save in order to reassure credit markets that we will get our fiscal situation under control. We know that right now, the path that we're on, very, very disturbing in that fiscal markets could lose faith at any time. And that's why one of the things I think is important is we need to get a deal done this year. This is not the kind of thing we should be saying, oh, we can wait till after the presidential election. We need to get something in place now to reassure credit markets. I think what the fiscal commission laid out, which was about
Bowles-Simpson.
Shared by Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson, a bipartisan commission of slightly more than $4 trillion over 10 years, basically should be seen as the bare minimum. I don't think anything less than that is quite enough. And the president's plan, it backloads – again, the numbers aren't there. We don't really know exactly what's in it. But it backloads a lot of the savings. So it's closer to $3 trillion or below in a 10-year period. That's not enough. We're going to need to see more than that. What I do credit him for is that he puts everything out there. There's defense. There's domestic discretionary, healthcare, Social Security revenues. He doesn't say what exactly he's going to do, but at least I think he's right to say we have to look at all those parts of the budget. But I'd say his plan is both light on details and light on savings. We're going to have to – it might be the starting point. It's not going to be the finishing point. We're going to have to do a lot more than what he proposed.
Linda Bilmes, let me bring the same question to you. Two paths here. But the basic question, do you buy that each of them, in its way, in their different ways, would get us to something more like a fiscal house in order? Do you see that both ways, Linda, or not?
Well, I don't really see it that way. I mean, I think that budgets are about two things. They're about revenues and expenditures. They're about how much money you take in and how much you spend. So it's like exercise and calories. And supposing you exercise 30 minutes a day and you eat too much, and then you cut your exercise down to 5 minutes a day and you eat too much. So you gain weight until your doctor says, hey, you are dangerously overweight and you need to lose 50 pounds. Does it make sense to do what Paul Ryan is saying, which is saying, well, let's forget about the fact that we cut out the exercise and let's just cut down across the board everything we're eating, regardless of whether it's broccoli or Twinkies? And the president is saying, well, the first thing we need to do is we need to get back to our normal amount of exercise, which in this case means restoring normal tax rates for the wealthy. And then let's cut back, but carefully, remembering that protein is different from fat, which in this case means that cutting spending, we need to differentiate between protecting money for education and science and infrastructure and things that strengthen our country over the long term.
You're expressing a preference for Obama's way, but would Ryan's way also get us to something closer to a reasonable fiscal situation?
Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is that if you were your Uncle Sam, who was then trying to lose 50 pounds without any exercise just by stopping eating. I mean, maybe you could get there, but you would not be a very healthy person at the end.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about two ways forward on the U.S. deficit, the Ryan plan, the Obama way, and what each would mean. Maya McGinnis joins us from Kansas City today, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, advised John McCain's presidential campaign in 2000. Linda Bilmes is with us from San Francisco. She worked in the late Clinton administration on management and budget at the U.S. Department of Commerce. Here's the president yesterday outlining his plan to drive down the deficit at George Washington University.
So this is my approach to reduce the deficit by $4 trillion over the next 12 years. It's an approach that achieves about $2 trillion in spending cuts across the budget. It will lower our interest payments on the debt by $1 trillion. It calls for tax reform to cut about $1 trillion in tax expenditures, spending in the tax code. And it achieves these goals while protecting the middle class, protecting our commitment to seniors, and protecting our investments in the future.
The president beginning to outline his framework yesterday. Republicans pushed straight back as Republican Congressman Jeb Hensarling of Texas.
This was not a speech designed for America to win the future. This was a speech designed for the president to attempt to win re-election.
Re-election? Well, everybody's in an election contest of one kind or another here. Maya, could you walk us through in the two, if we're going to, you know, get $4 trillion ahead of where we are now in each of these, where does each make its biggest savings? In the Obama case, what are the biggest chunks of deficit reduction? How do those compare to the biggest chunks of deficit reduction in the Ryan plan, Maya?
Okay, so remember, the Obama plan over the 10-year period, which you normally think about budgets, saves far less. It's probably less than $3 trillion.
Because he's stretching out to 12 years,
yeah,
and so he's
kind of cheating
by your lights in that way.
Elongated the period, yeah, okay. And I think we should be striving for saving $4 trillion, but over a normal decade, and again, that would be the minimum. So it's going to have to ramp up the savings.
So it's slower.
Yes, it's much slower and it's backloaded. So one of the problems is that when you want to reassure credit markets, they need to see serious down payments, serious savings. You don't want to save excessive amounts right now because we're still coming out of the economic recovery.
Right.
But you don't want to backload all of it so that it sort of, you know, trust us, we'll do it down the road.
Right. Promises are easier than cuts themselves.
They are. And one of the things I actually find quite intriguing about the Obama proposal is that they include a debt trigger or a fail-safe, which mm-hmm. basically says if we don't put these savings in place, automatic changes, automatic cuts will take place.
And soon.
And reasonably soon. It's
2014,
actually,
I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we probably need to put some of those in a little bit sooner.
Okay.
Debt triggers are something that actually we ran a commission, the Peterson-Pugh Commission, which recommended annual debt triggers, targets for savings on debt levels and bringing the debt down to a sustainable level, and triggers that would enforce those. And it's a really good idea, I think. It doesn't do the heavy lifting of policy, but it helps kind of cement a budget deal and
but
make sure
the
policymakers stay on track.
Yeah, but when the deficit reductions come in the Obama plan, where do they come?
Right. So, again, the numbers are a little bit light here, but they save a significant amount of money from defense, domestic discretionary, health care. They say something has to happen on Social Security, but their language is more about principles. They really – nobody really has started talking about what we're going to have to do to work on saving Social Security. And that can be done aside, sort of apart from the rest of the budget savings, but it has to be taken on with equal commitment as the rest of the budget. And then revenues. And those numbers that they put out, about $2 in saving for every one in tax increases and then one would come from interest savings, are accurate from what I've seen. Relative to their own fiscal commission, they save less on defense and a bit less on health care and a bit less on revenues. And so they end up having to do more on other mandatory spending, which is one of those areas where there's ag subsidies, pensions, a lot of the programs for the poor. So I was a little surprised to see that.
Do the health care savings look real to you or squishy? Paul Ryan's, are real in the sense that to the government itself, he's just getting it out of the business of guaranteeing on Medicare. So that's a savings. What about Obama?
So Obama expands a health care commission. There's a lot of commissions here. He expands a health care commission that he had in his health care bill that would recommend savings. This is called IPAB. And it's an idea that I really like. Unfortunately, because of the weakness of the political system to make tough choices, some ways you're outsourcing it. You're saying to the experts, we're going to need you, if we don't have the savings that we're hoping for in health care, to make additional recommendations about where those savings would come from. It's not necessarily the most sort of specific or courageous way to approach savings, but I think it's a mechanism that's very effective. So I like that idea of expanding how we could have savings. Congressman Ryan, on the other hand, is really specific. And what he's done, and he deserves so much credit for it. And again, if people don't like this idea, I think they should propose other ways to save healthcare savings. But the number one problem facing our budget is healthcare costs. What Congressman Ryan's budget does is he says we need to change Medicaid and Medicare. We're going to take the Medicaid money and we're going to give it directly to states in terms of block grants, and they're going to have more control over how that money is spent. On Medicare, he puts out a structure that I think is really worth serious consideration, which would be premium support, where you would actually subsidize individuals for their premiums of buying their insurance. And he then lets it grow at a very slow rate over time. So
that's cost shifting, right? I mean, then people are going to have to pick up their own costs because it's going to grow faster than what the government's offering. That would mean a savings for the government, but is it a – Obama made the case yesterday that that's not a humane way to go, that it leaves American citizens dangling out there kind of naked or half naked ultimately.
It's bringing market forces to a system which is desperately in need of some kind of competition and some kind of cost sharing. So it puts more of the responsibility on individuals, hopefully having them become more price sensitive. That's where it would hopefully save money. Where it doesn't save as much money is it has a higher administrative cost. It would cost more that way. But I think the point that's been made by many people is our healthcare system is severely broken. One thing that we know is that the health care bill that recently passed isn't going to be enough in terms of cost saving. And that's why one of the things the president is doing is now recommending more cost savings, ways to save money in health care. And I think that's the right thing. But they're not the structural reforms yet that Paul Ryan has recommended. Paul Ryan's approach isn't the only way to do it at all. I just think that if you don't care for that approach, then you need to have other options. The public option is another way that we could generate significant savings, something that would be more popular on the left. We need to put those ideas on the table. And frankly, where I am as an independent, I think I don't want to be in the position of saying I'm on the right or the left because I'm squarely in the center of these things. I'd like to see both structural changes, two different approaches to structural changes, working side by side to control healthcare costs. And so what you could do is have a premium support plan like Congressman Ryan has recommended, and also keep traditional Medicare in there, and then control the costs, limit how much we're going to subsidize all of those things, and see what systems can actually bring about savings. I think there's a real way to work on some compromises here. But the healthcare needs big, big changes. We are in trouble there.
Needs addressing. Linda, I want to come to you first. Here's the president yesterday on the Medicare front.
Let me be absolutely clear. I will preserve these health care programs as a promise we make to each other in this society. I will not allow Medicare to become a voucher program that leaves seniors at the mercy of the insurance industry with a shrinking benefit to pay for rising costs.
The president on Medicare there yesterday, also talking about Medicaid, Linda Bilmes. I mean, at that point, he's saying, I will not shrink, you know, off of these promises, these commitments. But, of course, elsewhere in his speech, he was speaking to liberals, progressives, and he says, you know, we can't delude ourselves. You've got a vision, but you've got to be able to pay for it. Do you see this adding up, Linda?
Well, the reason it adds up is the fact that the Ryan plan would give away another $1 trillion in new tax cuts to high-income Americans and business. So, in other words, he has to come up with essentially $5 trillion because he's giving up another trillion, whereas the president would collect another $1 trillion in revenues. So he has to only find $3 trillion. So that $2 trillion difference explains how the president can actually stabilize the debt while still preserving intact the basic structure of Medicare and Medicaid. What I think that the Ryan plan has done is it has raised the question of priorities in terms of us as a nation. Really, how much can we afford to subsidize health care? We know that health care is growing rapidly as a cost. I agree with Maya about the fact that this is the major problem looking ahead in terms of our budget. And so the fundamental debate, which is really whether or not we should as a nation be providing health care in the same way that we provide education as a basic right, is the question which I think Congressman Ryan is trying to reopen again. And the country moved last year when we enacted health care reform to a different kind of position in which we decided that we would try to ensure that every American had access to health care. What Congressman Ryan would do is he would essentially say we as a country would try and provide some health care, but not as much. Now, I also think that his plan would introduce an additional level of complexity into the system, which one of the better things about Medicare is that for the consumer, for the senior who is relying on Medicare, it's a simple system. And I think that we can easily underestimate how difficult it would be just to administer and to communicate.
But today we're looking at
how to do the new program.
Absolutely, I get that. But we're looking at fiscal responsibility here today. And I know it's all part of the picture, but can you get to a big deficit reduction and keep that commitment that the president's talking about? I mean, do those things fit in the same reality, Linda?
Well, you know, it depends on a couple of things. You know, one is it depends on how well the president's proposal to introduce to essentially strengthen the cost control measures in his original reforms, how well it works. And what that relies on is it relies on trying to introduce best medical practices. So we know a lot about what is the most efficient and the best in terms of outcomes type of disease management for a whole variety of chronic diseases, for example. But people don't necessarily get that kind of treatment. Now, what his plan would do is it would mandate that the federal board would mandate rather than just suggest a number of sort of cost-saving approaches for treating Medicare patients. Mm-hmm. And so one of the questions is whether that would actually work and whether that would actually generate as many savings as he has put forward.
Where things could get squishy, I want to get just a little bit of more of a Jim DeMint of South Carolina in here. This is part of the big Republican pushback yesterday on the president's speech. He's talking here with Greta Van Susteren on Fox News.
The president's not serious, and we've got to take our case to the people. The president tried to do that today. The only thing he recommended was about $1 trillion in new taxes to the job creators in our country. He didn't recommend any specific spending cuts. So we have to hold his feet to the fire. The key thing, Greta, is to recognize 2012 may be our last chance to change this as a country.
Certainly going to be a big debate on the way to 2012. Let me turn to our listeners, if I may. Don in Wetumpka, Alabama. Don, thanks for calling. You're on the air, Don.
Yes, greetings from the heart of Dixie.
Okay. What do you see?
Well, here's what I see. First of all, I want to address the analogy that one of the speakers offered earlier, and that is, if you're only exercising 5 minutes a day and you're eating too much, you can't simply solve your problem by decreasing the amount of food that you consume.
So more exercise, more taxes, she was saying. Yeah, okay.
Right. The problem with that analogy is that when the federal government doesn't exercise 5 minutes a day, it exercises an hour a day. The problem is not a revenue problem. The problem is a spending problem. The government takes in plenty of money. We are taxed to death. I pay taxes on my federal income, on my state income. I pay taxes on my cell phone, to which I'm speaking to you now.
Yep.
I pay taxes when I pay my electric bill, my cable bill, my water bill.
But we've still got a deficit.
A revenue problem.
Yeah.
That's right, because we have a bloated federal government that spends more than it makes.
So where would you cut? Where would you cut, Don?
Well, I would cut, first of all, we have to cut the social programs. There's nothing we can do. We can't deliver on these false promises that we've made. I spent over 15 years on active duty in the United States Air Force. I'm still a reservist. I'm a colonel in the United States Air Force Reserves, and I will tell you that we spend far too much money on our military. I would cut our military budget in half. We still have a Cold War military structure that we simply can't afford.
Don, let us pick it up right there, if we may, and I appreciate your call. Colonel Don says, cut the military. We'll look at that as well. Maya, to Don's larger point, he says, we don't have a revenue problem. We have a spending problem. And, of course, that is going to be right at the heart of the debate we hear politically in coming weeks and months and years. What about that? The president's very forthright in saying he wants higher-income Americans to pay more, significantly more. What about the revenue-spending ratio here, Maya?
So I've actually been traveling around the country a little bit for the past couple of days, and I have been hearing this point many, many times. And so let me weigh in how I see it. I think the caller is absolutely right that what we have is a spending problem. If you look going forward, both spending and revenues are projected to be significantly higher than their historical averages. Now, a big part of that, though, is that going forward, we have an aging population and healthcare costs are growing much faster than they have in the past because we want a lot of healthcare. We happen to like it if someone else pays for our healthcare, but we want a lot of healthcare. So I think this is accurate to describe as a spending problem, but I also think the reality is nobody, no political party actually is willing to cut spending enough that we can fix this entirely on the spending side. So the way that I look at it is the most important thing we can do here is reform our entitlement programs. We have to focus on health care. We have to focus on age-related programs. Social Security is going to grow significantly because more people are living longer, and we should think about raising the retirement age to reflect that we can all work longer. We're going to have to look at all the parts of the budget, including defense, domestic, discretionary, spending through the tax code. We spend $1 trillion a year through the tax code. We're going to make all those changes, and there's probably still going to be a need for more revenues because we are not willing to really look at entitlements for people who are currently retired. That means those changes are going to come in very, very gradually. And in the coming years, we still need to fill in the hole. And I do think that revenues have to be part of the solution just because the gap is so large and for a political compromise to occur, that needs to take place. But they need to be a small part of the solution because it is a spending problem. And also when it comes to kind of the rhetoric of class warfare, which we're hearing more and more about the tax cuts, let me be really sort of straightforward here. Taking a no new tax pledge, unless you can say how you would close the gap on spending cuts alone, doesn't make sense to me because I don't see anyone who's really put that out there. But at the same time, the White House has said they're not going to raise taxes on people making less than $250,000.
Mm-hmm.
That just doesn't add up with their numbers either. They are not willing to put enough savings on the table to make that true. So I wish we could bring down the rhetoric about, you know, just millionaires and billionaires. If we don't want to cut spending enough, and most politicians haven't laid out a path that would cut spending enough not to need revenues, you got to be willing to talk about broad-based revenue increases and how to do that without hurting the economy.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about two ways forward on the American deficit this hour, the Ryan Plan, the Obama way, and what each would mean. Maya McGinnis with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget joins us from Kansas City. Linda Bilmes of Harvard's Kennedy School joins us from San Francisco. Lots of response online. Dwight says neither plan is serious. He may have a piece of a point there. John says, I don't like how a fringe right-wing extremist Tea Party is given equal media attention in our national discussion. recession. Manipulative taxes tactics are pushing to serve covert big business. Molly says the top 10% of earners pay 70% of all income taxes collected by the government already, I guess she's saying. So fair would be 100% in your mind, she's asking, incredulous. The focus, says Molly, should be on cutting spending, not taking away people's earnings. Let's go to Stuart in Omaha, Nebraska. Stuart, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'd like to say that I go with the Obama plan because it actually, you know, works a little bit better for the people and help maintaining that safety net. You know, the Ryan plan, you know, it effectively removes government from doing the mandate that it has in the Constitution of promoting the general welfare of the people. You know, the Ryan plan wants to open up the door for big business to be able to exploit and capitalize off the wealth that's out there from the elderly and the sick.
Well, Stuart, let me ask you, Paul Ryan and Republicans say that taking care of the general welfare of the people requires a vigorous economy. We heard someone here today saying, you know, we've got to encourage the job creators. Stay out of their pocket, give them a tax break maybe. They'll create those jobs.
Well, they've had those tax breaks for the past 10 years, and the economy has shed jobs, millions of jobs. They've had these for the past 2 years, and they haven't aggressively began hiring again. So, you know, that argument, that holds no weight. It doesn't weigh out, you know.
Stuart, in Omaha, we've got it. I appreciate your call very much. Let me get one more here. Boston, Barbara is calling. Hi, Barbara, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you see?
Well, I've got a comment or question.
Okay.
I'm a moderate Republican, mm-hmm. and our household makes more than $250,000 a year, as do many of my friends.
Okay.
And many of my friends, myself included, would be happy to pay more taxes if either party would get to the fundamental beginning point of getting your, quote, fiscal house in order, mm-hmm. which is go through and get rid of all the duplicate spending. There's been commission reports on how much the government spends when it's duplicating its efforts, or bureaucracy is duplicating government jobs.
Yeah.
Let's start.
So make you a little more comfortable with how it's being spent, and you're prepared to pitch in. Linda Bilmes, is there a way to give that confidence? I mean, Obama is very clear. He's going to ask Barbara and her crowd to pay more. She says she's not willing to do that, you know, happily without some evidence that it's going to be spent more efficiently. That's the holy grail. Can we get there?
Well, I think Barbara has a very important point, because one of the fundamental problems with our budget is that we don't actually know where the money goes. And that seems incredible, and yet it's true. And that's because of the way we do budgeting. So, for example, supposing you were running a bakery and you had only a budget that told you how much flour and how much sugar and how much electricity you were spending money on, but you had no idea how many cakes and how many loaves of bread and you had no idea what actually came out of it. You only had the inputs. So that's essentially the federal government. We have hundreds of programs doing all different kinds of things, and we just know that we're paying salaries here and there and everywhere. We don't actually know, for example, how much money are we spending on climate change.
So why should Barbara step up with her extra taxes? I mean, she won't have a choice if she's asked to.
I have advocated for a very long time that we should have what sounds boring but is terribly important, but that we should have managerial cost accounting in government, which is what every business has. So we are actually able to identify what are the things that government does and how much money do we spend on these things. So if you wanted to figure out priorities for the country, for example, how much should we be spending on climate change, you shouldn't have to look in 15 different agencies, NOAA, NASA, the Science Foundation, the EPA, USAID, the State Department, et cetera, to look at what portion of people's salaries is going into climate change research. I mean, that project would take a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this would enable us to have the basic informational framework to be able to better prioritize where our money goes.
Maya, let me put that to you. Can we walk and chew gum at the same time here? If we need to tighten up so we understand that, as I mean, you're saying you see a lot to admire in Ryan's program, but you say we're probably going to need revenues and maybe from beyond 250 plus. We don't have a whole lot of time here, given how much time we haven't gotten that right. Kind of accounting together. Even if you look out to 2020, I mean, it's 9 years. Those years go quick. We all know that. Do we have the competence to get on top of this fiscal challenge in the time available?
Well, actually, let me plug Linda here, because she really is one of the nation's leading experts on how to do this. And I think this is about to come a huge issue. Mm-hmm. And I also want to applaud Barbara, because what she just offered is the kind of sense I'm getting from talking to all these voters right now. I had someone in the airport who came up the other day and said, listen, I would give back half my Social Security check. He's a retiree. If I knew that we were going to put in place a plan that would, one, fix the situation. Like, let's not sort of mess around and risk that we don't get this done. We have to fix the situation. And two, is fair. And what you hear from people all the time is they are willing to be part of the solution. And it's kind of, it's wonderful. And then you go back and you look at all this horrible finger pointing and fighting between the two parties instead of problem solving. I really agree with the sentiment, which is, we're all going to have to give something, but the bigger issue is, how is the government going to still do good with less? It's going to be, the challenge is going to be doing well in the public sector in an era of fiscal consolidation. We have to be realistic. We're going to spend less. We're going to spend a lot less. We do need to protect the productive public investments, but we don't need to call everything an investment and dump it into there and say we have to spend money on everything. We can pare back. We can have more oversight, better metrics, real cost-benefit analysis, and get serious about saying the government shouldn't do something unless it's working. And it's that kind of improved effectiveness of government that's going to make people more willing to kind of step up to the plate and be part of the solution. And
what about the
again,
Pentagon?
Again, I just think voters, I think voters are ahead of politicians here.
What about the Pentagon piece? Our Air Force Colonel Don, calling from Alabama, said he spent 15, 20 years in the active duty military. He says there's a lot that could be realized there in savings and deficit reduction. President Obama went well beyond what the Pentagon has offered, certainly beyond what Republicans are talking about. But how big a piece could that play? I mean, it's a gigantic budget. Could we find our salvation cutting there, Maya?
Absolutely. I mean, there's basically three areas there. One, there's waste, fraud, and abuse, which I usually mock when people start talking about closing the deficit from that, because it's not going to do it. But when it comes to the Pentagon, there are a whole lot of efficiencies and wasted monies which could be cleaned up. We can't even get a clean audit for this department. It's just too big. We don't even know how many contractors there are. So we can have real savings by better budgeting and oversight here. Two, and this gets a little bit more touchy, but actually the benefits, the compensation, things like TRICARE, there are a lot of benefits that while we're looking at entitlements in the rest of the budget, we need to look at in the Defense Department as well for real savings on health care, on retirement, things like that. And then three, we can have a bigger question about the U.S. role in the world. And as a non-security expert, I'll leave that one up to the security experts. But we can question whether our role in the world is appropriate or it should be smaller, which would save money. Or if it's not going to be, then how are we going to pay for it? But I don't think anybody should say defense should be off the table, because even if you think our role in the world should be exactly what it is now, there's still significant savings to be found from the security portion of our budget.
Let me get a call from Columbus, Georgia. And Sarah, hi, Sarah. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling because I support Obama. I support his position. What we've got right now are obstructionist Republicans and weak Democrats, and I like Obama's strength in this last speech that he made about what his intentions are. Look, cutting taxes on the wealthy and corporations is obscene. The Republicans are calling this job-making. They
yes.
have changed the language to disrupt the association. This is actually the trickle-down effect. It does not work. It has never worked. It's been proven not to work. All rich people do is go buy another car, or corporations pay a bigger bonus to their CEOs. If a government doesn't exist to promote the well-being of its citizens, then what's it for? We need these social programs. As for Medicare vouchers, how are they going to do that? Is that going to be a voucher directly to an insurance company, or is it going to be a free check to somebody? Well, we're so poor right now, you get an $8,000 check, and you're going to pay your rent with it.
I hear the question. I'm pretty sure it's going to be a closed loop where you can't just go to Vegas with it. But that doesn't mean it's going to be a perfect solution either. I appreciate your call. We've got it. Sarah, let me get one more here. Susan, Bardstown, Kentucky. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling in regards to the Medicare voucher program, and I work in a physician's office, and I do the insurance billing. Our office, I've been doing this for over 20 years. Mm-hmm. The office I'm working in has a high percentage of Medicare patients.
Okay.
And I deal with the Medicare patients every day. So many of them, first off, don't have computers, don't have access to the Internet, don't even know where to begin to do a price comparison. With the advent of the Medicare Advantage plans, which are plans that they can take in place of Medicare, so many of our patients have been inundated with unscrupulous insurance salesmen, and they're signed up for things that they have no clue of what they've signed up for.
So you're afraid they'll be baffled in a voucher world, not really giving that sort of a competitive analysis to their options that is the assumption of cost saving there?
Correct. I know they will be. I see it every day. They come to me even with bills from other physicians' offices because, you know, that's one of the things I do here. I help them with any insurance bills that they have, and they don't have a clue. I have a mother, you know, who is in Medicare age, and I help her with that. But I worry about the people who don't have children. You know, we're a spread-out society.
To help them out. But Susan, what about Paul Ryan says we've got to pound these costs down somehow. This is a way to do it. We just can't go on the same whistling on this path.
I agree with that, but I don't think it needs to be done on the backs of our seniors. You know, I understand we have to do cost savings. I agree with the president. The wealthiest 2% should pay more. Go back to the prior Bush tax cuts. If we want to go back to the prior Bush tax cuts, I'm definitely not in the 2%, but I would be willing to do that even in my income. It's just that you don't do this to our seniors.
Susan, I appreciate your call very much. There are times running short, but I'm so grateful to hear from your direct experience of this situation. Susan there in Bardstown. Let me get a call from Vermont, if I may. Sutton, Vermont, and Rob. Hi, Rob. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would just like to say that if Congress was serious about cutting billions out of the budget, they should look at the subsidies to all industries, but especially to the renewable energy industry, the 1603 grants and the 1705 loan guarantees.
What is that, ethanol, or what is that, Rob?
Those are direct grants given to wind developers to build projects for intermittent, inefficient wind turbines that aren't creating jobs, that aren't green, and the ethanol subsidies would be good ones to cut, too.
Rob, let us pick those up. Linda Bilmes, is it clear in the Paul Ryan plan, in the Barack Obama plan, where these big industry subsidies would go, where they'd like to see them go, Linda?
Well, I think that the issue of the tax system and needing tax reform is not addressed fully in either plan, probably more so in the Obama plan. But this is an area, actually, where Maya McGinnis has done some very interesting research. And we now spend over $1 trillion in various kinds of tax breaks to all different kinds of people and interest. For example, we allow people to deduct interest on home mortgages up to $1 million.
And a lot of people say, thank heavens. I don't know about up to $1 million.
Right.
I don't know, but, everybody.
I mean, the question is, the question is that if we are serious about tackling expenditures, there are two ways that we spend money. One is above the table, kind of, and the other is below the table through the tax system. So we have to take a look at what can we actually afford. I mean, how much money can we actually afford to spend on subsidizing mortgages? How much money can we actually afford to or want to spend on tax breaks for farmers who grow corn? And ethanol subsidies and so forth, and that has got to be it's a more difficult area to look at because the tax system is opaque. But we have just heard that GE, for example, legally paid no taxes last year,
right,
despite substantial profits. Now, if we heard that GE illegally paid no taxes, that would be an easy problem to fix. But the problem is that what they did was perfectly legal.
Right. It's legal. Maya, if I may bring you to Maya, I'm sorry, Linda, but our time grows short, and I want to get Maya's expertise that you referred to. Maya, We've just got a minute and a half here, a couple of minutes, but compare these two plans when it comes to Rob's point, subsidies and tax breaks. Which do you see as more effective in going? That is a huge amount of money.
Well, President Obama really hasn't laid out his plan for this yet. He just said that we can cut tax expenditures. But the Fiscal Commission has in the most detail. And the truth is there is over $1 trillion in spending through the tax code. We can bring rates down significantly and raise revenue if we look at those. And I just want to point out that while the president put out the right discussion yesterday on the table, he still hasn't been specific. And while Congressman Ryan has put out huge, specific, and I think very courageous reforms, they're going to take more time to talk about and think about and analyze than we have to get a deal in place right now. And I just want to take a step back and remind folks that the Fiscal Commission, chaired by Bowles and Simpson, came up with what I think is a great starting point. And actually, the good news is that in the Senate, there's the so-called gang of six, but six senators, three Republicans, three Democrats, Warner, Chambliss, Coburn, Conrad, Durbin, and Crapo, who have been working together the way that we actually need to wrestle with this plan and come up with the details about how to move forward on that as a compromise. And that, I think, is what we need to do to move this ball forward, work together in a bipartisan way on compromising.
Maya, we've got 15 seconds here. How long do we have to get a first whack at this going one way or another? Can it be on the other side of the 2012 vote, or does it have to be sooner?
I really don't think we can wait. I think we have to get something in place before the election. It's just not worth risking it.
Maya McGuinness, joining us today from Kansas City, Missouri, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Maya, thanks as always for being with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Linda Bilmes in San Francisco today, professor of budgeting and public finance at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Linda, thank you very much for your insights today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, it's going to be a long road. Let's buckle up and hope we can do it right. Thank you for joining us today. 800-42- Oh, you know that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.